Welcome to Break the Chains, America's top radio source of information for people struggling with drug or alcohol addiction and those who love them. And now, the host of Break the Chains, Gwen Cardin.
How many American women do you think die each year of substance abuse-related illnesses? I find the answer to that question quite astounding. 200,000. In addition to those deaths, there are 4 million women in this country right now who are in need of treatment for their addiction. Those statistics are both startling and tragic. Interestingly, although we're talking about some pretty big numbers, only recently has it come to light that there are significant gender differences when it comes to addiction. These differences are biological, psychological, and sociological. For decades, there's been kind of a one-size-fits-all approach to treating women based on what was known about men. And in many pockets of America, ignorance about this issue persists. On today's show, we're going to pull the cover off some long-held misconceptions about women addicts. Our goal is to shed light on the true and tragic reality that has for too long been swept under the rug. My guests today are Twyla Wilson and Linda Gingra. Twyla is a licensed clinical social worker and psychotherapist in Durham, North Carolina. She trains professionals on gender-responsive, trauma-informed treatment for women. And prior to being in private practice, she was a faculty member at Duke University Medical Center in the departments of psychiatry and social work. At Duke, she started a women's addiction treatment program. Linda Gingra is a licensed marriage and family therapist and a board-certified alcohol and drug counselor. She serves as the director of addiction and prevention services at Jewish Family Service in Los Angeles, where she coordinates and provides substance abuse services for chemically dependent clients and their families. She's also president of the Women's Association for Addiction Treatment, a national professional organization for women in the addiction field. Welcome, Twyla and Linda.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here, Gwen.
Well, I'm really happy to have you both. I want to direct the first question to you, Twyla, but as our conversation progresses, I really want to invite you two just to kind of chime in as you see fit. Let me ask you, Twyla, let's start with this question. Are women more susceptible to addiction than men?
Well, our data on that has been a little unclear because, as you referenced earlier, a lot of the research in this field has been done on men's addictions. Women's addictions really didn't come to light in our society until the 1970s. But we're starting to get a body of knowledge that says, yes, indeed, women's addictions are different and the way that addiction impacts their physical self is different, as well as there are some physical things about women that impact how drugs and alcohol affect their bodies.
What would some of those things be?
Well, we know that with shorter periods of use and less use of alcohol and other drugs, women tend to have more physical complications for that. In my work at Duke, for example, I would see women in their early 30s who were dying of cirrhosis of the liver after maybe only a decade of drinking, and I'd see men in their 60s and 70s who had been drinking heavily for several decades who still had intact livers. That's one example.
Mm-hmm. Linda, do you have anything to add?
Well, I think the idea of being able to identify and acknowledge what addiction even is with women, because so many of the expectations of women, and I think we'll talk about this if we talk about the physiological, psychological, and sociological issues as well, but to deal with the shame and the symptoms and to identify them as what they are, and that we are looking at chemical dependency and the body's changes in reaction to chemicals has been difficult for women to acknowledge in when they address the shame piece, and I'm sure we'll be talking more about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Now, is there any evidence that women become dependent on substances faster than men? I know you said they certainly die more quickly in many cases, but are they dependent faster?
I don't know the research on that, but I think because of the shame and stigma attached with the disease of addiction, that we often don't find out about women's addiction as early as we might with men.
So in other words, it's just not addressed as quickly or acknowledged as quickly, and therefore it can go on
and the
longer.
The consequences may be more serious by the time it's actually begun to be addressed.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So now, we know that several things like being a mom or being a woman carries a different level of stigma with it that prevents women from getting into treatment maybe as easily as men are identified and access treatment.
Mm-hmm. And I do want to talk about that in a few minutes, but I'd like to ask just a little bit more about the physiological aspects of addiction. Do women get intoxicated more easily?
Linda, do you want to take that?
Well, I think often that is the case because women's bodies are different. Often, and of course there's always exceptions, but women's bodies are usually smaller. So the amount of alcohol will affect them sooner. For example, the amount of a controlled substance can create intoxication on a smaller body sooner. Their metabolisms are different. So often they will show the signs of physiological intoxication sooner than men or with less intake.
I remember years ago. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say because women have a higher fat content in their bodies, not calling women fat, but we just have a greater content percentage-wise than men do. The way that our bodies process substances is more impactful.
I remember years ago, 2020 locked a group of men and women into a room and allowed them or asked them to drink excessively, and it was obvious really quickly how much faster the women were becoming impaired than the men. And it did have to do, I guess, with metabolism, smaller body size, smaller livers, and that kind of thing. So I think the idea of a woman saying, well, I can drink and keep up with the best guy may be more of a boast than a reality in most cases. Do you agree?
Yes, but there are also biological issues, hereditary issues that impact how one's brain and one's liver are set up to process alcohol in particular. And so if you have more acetaldehyde and alcohol dehydrogenase in your liver, even as a woman, you can usually drink large amounts of alcohol and not feel the effects of them as quickly as someone who didn't have that biological predisposition.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know about that. So when you have, what were you saying? You have aldehydes in your liver?
You have enzymes in your liver that break down the toxins in alcohol, for example. And so if you have a lot of those two enzymes, you can drink and drink and drink, and your liver goes to work overtime to break down the effects of the alcohol. So you can be physically impaired, but you don't feel it as quickly. So whereas the average American woman, according to the AMA, might have 1.5 drinks and begin to feel the effects of that and just gradually lose interest in drinking any further. If your brain and your body hereditarily predispose you to not get the right messages, you can have 6 or 7 drinks and you're going to feel fine. And in fact, you'll want to continue to drink to get even more of a buzz because it takes longer.
Hmm. Very interesting. That was something I had not read or learned about. Now, I also understand that there has been some research or some people taking a pretty serious look at the role of estrogen and addiction in women. Twyla, what can you tell us about that?
Well, we know that the chemicals in the brain of dopamine and serotonin impact our ability to feel pleasure and to feel calm and to feel a sense of well-being. And we know that estrogen really impacts both dopamine and serotonin levels in the brain. And so what we're seeing is that craving, and the desire to use to mitigate some of those hormonal shifts, such as higher emotionality, greater anxiety, greater irritability, more tendency to depression that comes with the estrogen shifts and the dopamine shifts, really impact women's desire to use or their difficulty in staying abstinent.
So again, that's really a huge gender difference there that has probably not been really considered until recent years, from what I'm gathering.
Absolutely. And what we tend to do is we tend to dumb that down with psychotropics and treat the depression or the anxiety rather than look at some basic physiological issues such as thyroid, such as hormone fluctuations, which can also cause those symptoms that psychotropics medicate.
So,
and I think so many women... Oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, I think so many women also can probably relate to that idea of having cravings during different times in their cycle. And, you know, often we think about sugar cravings, but there's a real connection between how sugar and alcohol, for example, are metabolized in the body. There's a desire to somehow address that craving through intake and self-soothing. And I think that just that susceptibility to want to address cravings and in a way that is an ingested behavior creates kind of a ritual, and that can lead to repeated behavior that has a reward attached to it, and then, of course, lead to dependent behavior. And on a little bit of a tangent there, I think women are often more susceptible to chronic pain conditions that can be medicated and then create dependency, like conditions like fibromyalgia, for example, which has been largely looked at as something that's maybe in a woman's head, or we're still starting to understand as a real condition, and so it's often treated with painkillers or anti-anxiety medication or that kind of thing, and again creating that phenomenon of sort of accidental addiction.
And I would think in many cases women are more likely to go to the doctor and say, I'm having this pain, than men, who are just going to suck it up, and therefore they are more likely to get prescriptions, which can ultimately cause a problem for them if it's not managed properly.
Right.
Yes, and I think the percentages show nationally that women get prescribed more narcotics and psychotropics than men do. So there's a lot of cultural and physical issues that go into that.
And
certainly not all medications create addiction and dependency, but when we look at the classes like the narcotics and the psychotropics that can have addictive potential, it's so interesting, and I think there really is an intersection with the psychological and sociological aspects here, because when women do present for treatment in a doctor's office, when they're talking about issues like sleeplessness or chronic pain that may come from their lifestyles related to raising children or working or maybe even being victims of abuse, anxiety medications, painkillers, and sleeping medications just happen to be classes of drugs that certainly can create addictive potential.
Okay, very good. Well, listen, it's time to take a short break, but stay tuned. We'll be right back with more interesting conversation about women and addiction in just a couple of minutes, so don't go away.
Is there someone you love who is suffering from alcohol or drug addiction? Do you feel like you simply don't know where to turn? We at Addiction Recovery Helpline know how painful it can be for both your loved one and for you and your family. We also realize that it's never easy to send someone you care about into rehab, but it's easier when you partner with us. Let Addiction Recovery Helpline assist your adult loved one to break the chains of addiction by finding just the right treatment center to meet their needs. Call us today toll-free at 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844-2-BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. It's too important to wait even one more day to make that call. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or on the web at getsobernow.net. Most insurance plans accepted.
If you're an adult suffering from drug or alcohol addiction, why not make today the day that you break the chains? At New Life Addiction Treatment Center in Port St. Lucie, Florida, we know it's not easy to pick up the phone and make that call. But remember, the caring staff at New Life is here to help. Count on us to partner with you to guide you towards getting your life back. Our confidential residential program takes most insurance plans and is designed to help meet your unique needs. Write this number down and give New Life Addiction Treatment Center a call right now. The toll-free number is 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844-2-BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. Your life is waiting for you, and so are we. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or getsobernow.net.
And now, back to Gwen Cardin on Break the Chains.
Welcome back to Break the Chains and today's topic, Women and Addiction. Our guests today are Twyla Wilson and Linda Gingra. And before we went on break, we were discussing some of the physiological aspects in which women are different from men. And Twyla, before we move on to the psychology that's different, I'd like to ask you one more question, and that is, are we seeing changes in the treatments to address hormonal fluctuations in women?
I think slowly but surely that's starting. For example, I was just reading a piece that was written by someone at the Hanley Center in Florida who said that now on women who are admitted for residential treatment, they're doing hormonal shift assessments and then setting up a treatment plan to address that, which is a really brilliant new endeavor, I think, to address this particular area, which has been an area of great oversight, I think, in this field. I would also add, I mentioned that we thought that hereditarily that the predisposition for being addicted to alcohol ran more strongly through the male line, and then somebody pointed out, well, you know, all the research has been done on men. And so once we started researching women, we found that, yes, indeed, it runs as strongly through the female hereditary link as it does with men.
So when you're testing for hormonal fluctuations, is that some sort of a blood test, or how do you test for that?
I think you would have to have a medical test, such as a blood test, and then you would also be having a person track very carefully, a woman track, over the course of a month, mood swings and what's going on with that, and then try to address a relapse prevention plan accordingly.
So this is really a much more targeted way to help to treat someone struggling with addiction than just across the board, well, do this, this, and this. Now it's saying, well, you know that in this these particular days of your monthly cycle, you're going to have more cravings. Therefore, you're going to be more susceptible to wanting to use and therefore put into place some sort of plan to address that when it gets a little bit more challenging than it is the other times of the month. Is that correct?
Yes, and I think it actually helps people when they understand that there's a physiological component to it. When we talk about the brain and how that's impacted with disease, the disease of addiction, my experience has been that people always go, oh, wow, you know, there's something I can hang on to there. It's not just that I'm a bad person or I'm not working my program as hard as I should be, but there are other issues that impact that we may not have been aware of and treating appropriately.
But could this also be an opportunity for people to, I don't know, say women are once again the victims of their hormones? You hear that in things that are a little bit sexist anyway. So is there a danger here of maybe misusing this, and it's got to be presented in such a way that we are respectful of women's differences and not critical of them?
What a beautiful segue into the sociological issues that impact women in terms of addiction, because absolutely, yes. And probably all three of us have cringed at some point when somebody said, oh, well, it must be that time of the month. That's why she's so cranky. You know, that comes sort of from a male-based society. And I'm sorry if anybody says that our society is gender neutral. I really don't believe that's true. I believe it still is male-based. And so that impacts how some of these issues for women are looked at.
So let's talk just a little bit about some psychological aspects of women in addiction, and then we have a lot, because my biggest section of questions has to do with sociological things, which would kind of surprise me when I started putting the list together and I realized how hugely different differently society does look at that. But
yes,
are, in many cases, are women's motivations to use drugs or alcohol different from those of men?
Linda, do you want to take that? I'm happy to, but go ahead.
Well, I think that there is a tendency for men to use to enhance a good feeling, to celebrate, to go out. And again, I know this is a sweeping generalization, but the idea of, you know, going out with the boys and having some beers to party and celebrate, where for women the use is often to self-soothe or self-medicate some sort of a condition, to deal with stress at the end of the day, or to address depression, or to help self-soothe some other sort of discomfort. And interestingly, and I know we're talking a lot about alcohol, alcohol has a unique effect of essentially taking whatever mood somebody's experiencing and intensifying it. So yes, when somebody starts drinking when they're happy and celebrating, they may feel less inhibited and looser. However, when somebody starts drinking when they're angry, it's a small step to getting very belligerent. When they start drinking when they're already depressed, even though the intent is to get to that numb anesthetic kind of feeling, the end result is often an intensification of the depression and, you know, potentially even intensifying to suicidal behavior, because the inhibitions are lowered and the mood is actually intensified. So the motivation to self-soothe or to anesthetize often kind of has an exactly opposite effect.
And I think for women, there are two particular issues that predispose their use. One is a history of trauma that has been unaddressed or untreated. And the other issue is relational in context. Women are very relational in nature, and they often use in response to the relationships in which they are involved. That's not to blame a partner or a family member, but sometimes women will use alcohol or drugs to connect with somebody else, or to ease the pain of a disconnection or an abusive situation.
And is this much more common in women than it is in men, this particular reason for using?
Well, statistically, yes, we see that there are very high levels, there are much higher levels of abuse in women's lives than there are in men. However, we do suspect that there is some underreporting of that. However, when I teach, what I talk about is the difference in abuse in the lives of women over the lifespan. For example, we know that both boys and girls are at risk for abuse in childhood, sexual abuse, emotional, physical abuse, with a spike at about age 5. That changes in adolescence, where we see that boys are more at risk for being hurt by people who don't like them. For example, peers, rival gang members, police, people who take issue with their race or their sexual orientation. And we see that girls are most at risk for being hurt by those to whom they are saying, "I love you." And then that changes in adulthood, and we see that men are most at risk for being assaulted or hurt as victims of crime or by going to war, being involved in combat. And we see that women are still most at risk for being hurt by those to whom they are saying, "I love you." And while any violence is abhorrent, at least there's a congruence between if you don't like me and you hurt me versus if you're saying you love me and you hurt me. That's kind of crazy making. And I think that plays a role in why women use drugs and alcohol.
And also to sort of build on that, We talked about using alcohol to release inhibition. Sometimes in social situations, you know, for men to go out and connect with women in either a physical way or some sort of a flirtatious way, there's kind of that idea of making a conquest or being the man. Where often for women to participate maybe in a relationship physically in a way they're not ready to, or to socialize effectively, there might be this sense of needing to somehow change their mind or their mood in order to participate in that, you know, to lower their inhibitions so that they can be sexually available to somebody, or dance better or flirt better. And interestingly, something else just to kind of comment there, we talked about the importance of relationship for women. And I think there's an interesting irony that for people that actually develop a chemical dependency, an addiction to a substance or a behavior, if you talk to somebody who's dealing with that addiction, that actually becomes the relationship. You know, women have such a craving for intimacy. And the relationship to alcohol, for example, I've talked to a lot of women that will say that alcohol is like their best friend, or that their cocaine is like their lover, because it's the one thing that's always there. It doesn't talk back. It's always available. It delivers a reliable effect. It doesn't let them down. So especially in the, with these women that have maybe the background of abuse or a long history of being hurt, in an ironic sort of way, even though it's killing them, the alcohol or the drugs may have been the longest term and most reliable relationship they've ever had in their lives.
Absolutely. Yes. And so that addiction, or that use relationship, starts as a love relationship, but as addiction progresses, we all know things start to fall apart, and eventually it gets to be a love, hate, or an abusive relationship as well. And we find that women often enter treatment less because there are external factors driving them to do that, such as problems with the law or problems with employers, but they come into treatment because they just can't stand the way their lives are any longer.
Is that different from why men would be seeking treatment?
Often men seek treatment because some sort of happening has occurred and there's pressure for them to go to treatment. Women more often go because they feel that they can no longer stand themselves and the chaos that their life is in. It feels like anything could fall apart at any moment, usually for women, by the time they come in.
In treatment, we talk about the difference between an external motivation and an internal motivation. You know, a lot of times for men, the external motivation is you're going to lose the job, or you're going to go to jail for the third time, or your wife is going to leave you. I mean, there's some sort of, whether it's put to them as an ultimatum or not, there's some sort of external consequence that is finally enough for them to say, at least in this moment in time, I don't want to keep living this way. Where for the women, it's often, as Twyla said, that internally motivated, I can't stand myself, the shame, the guilt, I can't keep living this way, I can't keep managing my life if I continue this way.
Yes.
And I think it's really interesting, the points that you all have made about the relationships being such a key part of why women are medicating, that it's the relationships aren't going well, and they're hurting themselves, I suppose, if they're not able to, if they don't have the skills perhaps to make that better with their partner or their loved ones, they just turn it on themselves and they self-medicate and hurt themselves.
Yes, there's a whole theoretical foundation for women's psychological development that came out of the Stone Center, the scholars at the Stone Center at Wellesley College back in the 70s. And maybe after the break, we can talk about a little bit more of the relational nature of women.
Yes, that would be very interesting thing to do. Well, I'll tell you what, then that's our cue. Why don't we take a break? And we'll continue our discussion about women and addiction in just a couple of minutes. So don't go away.
Is there someone you love who is suffering from alcohol or drug addiction? Do you feel like you simply don't know where to turn? We at Addiction Recovery Helpline know how painful it can be for both your loved one and for you and your family. We also realize that it's never easy to send someone you care about into rehab, but it's easier when you partner with us. Let Addiction Recovery Helpline assist your adult loved one to break the chains of addiction by finding just the right treatment center to meet their needs. Call us today toll-free at 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844-2-BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. It's too important to wait even one more day to make that call. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or on the web at getsobernow.net. Most insurance plans accepted.
If you're an adult suffering from drug or alcohol addiction, why not make today the day that you break the chains? At New Life Addiction Treatment Center in Port St. Lucie, Florida, we know it's not easy to pick up the phone and make that call. But remember, the caring staff at New Life is here to help. Count on us to partner with you to guide you towards getting your life back. Our confidential residential program takes most insurance plans and is designed to help meet your unique needs. Write this number down and give New Life Addiction Treatment Center a call right now. The toll-free number is 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844-2-BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. Your life is waiting for you, and so are we. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or getsobernow.net.
Welcome back to Break the Chains. Here again, your host, Gwen Cardin.
Before we resume the conversation, I'd like to remind you that I really appreciate receiving feedback and ideas from listeners, and I'd especially like to hear from you. So please take a couple of minutes after the show to email me your ideas and comments at addictionradioshow@gmail.com. We are talking today to Twyla Wilson and Linda Gingra about women and addiction. I'd like to ask something about dual diagnosis. This is a term that I have been hearing a lot more recently than I think we heard a few years ago. And Linda, can you talk to us, what does that mean? If somebody has a dual diagnosis, how does that relate to substance abuse?
The term dual diagnosis, or another term that essentially means the same thing as the idea of a co-occurring disorder, this is a presentation where somebody presents with an addiction to a substance or a compulsive behavior, and at the same time, some sort of mental health issue, like somebody who is alcohol dependent and dealing with depression, or somebody who has an anxiety disorder and they're using a narcotic, for example. And for a long time in treatment, it was sort of addressed in a linear fashion. Let's find out why you're so depressed, and we'll deal with the depression, and then if we figure out why you're depressed, maybe you won't have to drink so much. Or traditional treatment programs or self-help groups often felt, well, if you just get sober, your depression will go away. And we have a much better understanding now that in treatment, these issues are co-occurring, they are separate but interrelated, and that it's essential that they're treated together. And so treatment programs that address dual diagnosis issues are integrating the idea of addressing the mental health or the emotional condition at the same time we're building recovery skills, so that when the person is completed with the primary phase of treatment, they'll be better equipped to deal with both conditions rather than sort of dealing with the one first and the next in a linear fashion. They really do need to be addressed together.
Yes. We're also understanding now that trauma plays such a great role in women's addictions that I ask people who are treating women to use what Dr. Covington calls a trauma lens, which means essentially I assume that there is trauma in a woman's history until hopefully I'm proven otherwise. And my goal in addiction treatment for women who have trauma histories is not recovery from addiction, but it's recovery from trauma. Because if you don't treat and heal the trauma, someone is not going to be able to maintain sobriety and abstinence. So that also makes me look at relapse a little bit different in women's lives. We used to have this mantra in the substance abuse field that said, you know, well, when you've been sober for a year, then we'll start working on your trauma. Because if we start working on that too early, then you're going to relapse and you won't be able to stay sober. So what would happen essentially is that women would come into treatment. The substances that they'd been using to medicate the pain of PTSD, of dissociation, of flashbacks, was all removed, and they were flooded with trauma symptomatology, and they'd leave treatment. And so we'd say things pejoratively like, well, I guess she's not ready to do the hard work of treatment yet, or, you know, maybe she hasn't just hit her bottom yet. When instead we were really failing them as treatment providers, we needed to simultaneously be providing treatment for their mental health issues and their trauma symptomatology at the same time we were providing treatment for recovery from drug and alcohol addiction.
Because am I correct in my understanding that a lot of times the substance abuse is more a symptom of the underlying trauma, that it wasn't just substance abuse for the sake of, well, she just had that gene, although that's also possible, but the fact
yes.
that the trauma really underlies the substance abuse, which is an attempt to self-medicate. Am I following
yes,
that?
Absolutely, yes. And there's a really important body of knowledge that comes out of something called the ACE study, which is Adverse Childhood Experiences. It's a huge study. You can find a lot of information about it online. And what we have seen there is that the bad things that happen to you in childhood predispose you to higher levels of addiction in adulthood, both for men and women, but sometimes up to 7 times greater for women than for men.
Why is it so much greater for women?
Well, because I think women still are at highest risk of sexual abuse. They're at higher risk than men are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to get into this whole sociological section of this conversation, because it's really significantly different for women than men. We've alluded to it a little bit in the course of our talk today, but what would you say, and I'll give you a chance, maybe Twyla, you, what you think is the most important, and maybe Linda also on the top of the list of, you know, how is society treating women differently to the extent that it negatively impacts their sobriety?
Wow, there's so many ways to answer that. Where to start? Let's start with shame and stigma. I'll give an example of a woman I worked with who had been pulled for a DUI one night in a parking lot of a grocery store, and it was a small town, and the cop who knew her asked her when she rolled down the window, "Where are your children?" Now, that is not a question that a man is probably going to get asked when he gets stopped for a DUI charge. So we have a lot more stigma associated with women's addiction, because often women have the role of caring for children, and so we think of active addiction as equaling being a bad mom. We also comment on women's addictive behavior in terms of their sexual behavior. There's lots of slanderous terms that can be used about a woman in terms of her sexuality when she's actively addicted, and we don't usually ever do that about men. Mm-hmm. So right there, two big issues that are different for women. And research Dr. Covington has done around the world shows that shame and stigma in all cultures are greater for women with addiction than the levels of shame and stigma for men.
In all cultures, very interesting.
All cultures, yes, across the world.
Hmm. Linda, what do you think are some of the sociological impacts that really make it tough for women?
Well, I think that role of trying to be a woman and a mother, or a woman and a partner in society, and then the shame and the stigma, not only creates the emotional and psychological barrier to entering treatment, but also some real logistical issues you know, when a single mom is raising children, how can she go to residential treatment when she's got children and there's no partner support? You know, there might actually be a real issue there. A woman who is financially dependent on her husband, for example, for resources, and if he's maybe even an abuser of some sort, and then she needs to, in part of her aftercare, for example, she needs to go to her self-help groups, or she needs to go to her counseling appointments to meet the requirements of the court system or to reinforce her recovery, and then he can pull the threat, if you continue to do this, then I can withhold your insurance, or I can not allow you transportation to get to where you're going. You know, there's a lot of barriers that are just...
I'll get custody of the kids. Yeah, if you go to treatment and I don't want you to go to treatment. It can be used against their mother role. Exactly, Linda.
And
I still don't know of...
Go ahead, Linda.
Even hear that phrase, I don't want you to go to treatment, sounds so counterintuitive. But when we think about the idea of active addiction essentially keeping a woman vulnerable and away from her resources, you know, sometimes in some abusive relationships, there's some power in keeping the woman away from her resources. And so the man might actually not be invested in her recovery, in other words, in her developing health.
Yes. And also, I don't know of any of the major treatment centers in the United States that would provide child care for young children while women come to treatment. Because somebody has to take care of the kids, and we don't support that nationally as a society for working women. We certainly have not gotten to supporting that for women going in for treatment for addiction.
So there is really there's a lot of additional stresses and strains that men, for the most part, are not going to experience. I suppose single dads would certainly have the same challenge where it would come to child care, but maybe they're not. Are you saying that they're not experiencing quite the social stigma that the females do?
Yes, we in many ways just don't want to think about women's addiction because societally that's something that feels not right. You know, we want moms to be okay. And when moms aren't okay, I mean, they're supposed to sort of hold up the world. And when they can't do that, it's very difficult for us to figure out how to help them.
I read a statistic that said 40% of alcoholics are female, but only 25% get treatment, and that seemed like some of these things that we're talking about could definitely be contributing to just making it just a whole lot harder for women to even do it.
And then the whole economic issue cannot be underplayed. I mean, there's just been a lot of information out in the last month about equal pay for women, and we're still at 79 cents on the dollar. And for African American women, that's 51 cents on the dollar compared to what a man would get for equal work. So that's a huge economic barrier for getting child care and going to treatment.
Well, and I think, too, that if women are often working part-time, they don't have the benefit maybe of health insurance. Maybe Obamacare is going to change some of that, but they maybe not even have the coverage to do it because they have chosen to stay home and be with their children. So once again, there's a financial barrier for them.
But interestingly, what the studies show is that if women do get to treatment, and if treatment is gender responsive, meaning it really addresses the realities of women's lives, that women do better. They stay sober longer, they stay engaged longer, and they become more functional in their roles.
Linda, did you want to say something?
Well, I think I absolutely agree with that when women get into treatment, the possibility for a fulfilling and thriving recovery is great. But we're talking about some of the actual logistical barriers to getting into treatment. But those logistical barriers can't even be there until the person actually acknowledges that there is a need for treatment. And when we put it in that context that we've been discussing of the shame and the guilt and the needing to essentially deny the presence of the addiction or to not recognize the addiction, that complicates things. And there's such an I think in anybody that's dealing with an addiction, you in the beginning, before they can really admit and acknowledge, there is a whole process of denying and rationalizing and minimizing, you know, how much do you drink? Well, I only had two drinks. Yes, but they were each 40 ounces or, you know, something. How are we reframing it? And, you know, that women have a lot of ways to kind of relabel. Oh, I'm just drinking to relax at the end of the day. I'm taking my anti-anxiety medication to cope with the stress of the kids, or I'm frightened when my husband's coming home at the end of the day, so I'm just doing that to cope, and not really acknowledging the addictive relationship. And we often think about addicts just being liars, and I would just throw out there that denial is a much more complicated piece than that. It's not just lying to the world, I know I have a problem, I'm going to tell you I don't. It's actually convincing themselves. And in fact, they have a saying in AA that the word denial, D-E-N-I-A-L, stands for don't even know I am lying.
I want to continue that thought in just a minute, so hang on to the denial. Let's come back to it, but we have to take a quick break right now, but we'll be right back.
If you're an adult suffering from drug or alcohol addiction, why not make today the day that you break the chains? At New Life Addiction Treatment Center in Port St. Lucie, Florida, we know it's not easy to pick up the phone and make that call. But remember, the caring staff at New Life is here to help. Count on us to partner with you to guide you towards getting your life back. Our confidential residential program takes most insurance plans and is designed to help meet your unique needs. Write this number down and give New Life Addiction Treatment Center a call right now. The toll-free number is 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844, the number 2, BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. Your life is waiting for you, and so are we. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or getsobernow.net.
Is there someone you love who is suffering from alcohol or drug addiction? Do you feel like you simply don't know where to turn? We at Addiction Recovery Helpline know how painful it can be for both your loved one and for you and your family. We also realize that it's never easy to send someone you care about into rehab, but it's easier when you partner with us. Let Addiction Recovery Helpline assist your adult loved one to break the chains of addiction by finding just the right treatment center to meet their needs. Call us today toll-free at 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844, the number 2, B-E-S-O-B-E-R. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. It's too important to wait even one more day to make that call. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or on the web at getsobernow.net. Most insurance plans accepted.
You're listening to Break the Chains, America's top radio source of information for people struggling with drug or alcohol addiction. Here's your host, Gwen Cardin.
Before we resume talking about women and addiction with our guests, Twyla Wilson and Linda Gingra, I want to invite you to go to our Facebook page and like us. You can find it at www.facebook.com/breakthechains1. Before we went on break, Linda, you were talking about denial, and I think that was a really hot topic, and I was sorry I had to interrupt you in the middle of it. So, but let's continue. What were you saying about denial that you think is so key to women's sobriety?
Well, I think obviously whenever we have a problem, we can't really address the problem until we acknowledge that the problem exists. And to acknowledge that my relationship with substances has become such that it is creating a problem in my life is a huge admission. You know, it takes, you know, we look often at the person who's an addict as somebody who's weak or criminal or bad or all of the moralizing that goes with it. But when you think about that piece that is requiring somebody, anybody, before they enter treatment, to really acknowledge that my relationship with this substance has gotten to a point where I can't manage my life anymore, what a lot of courage that takes. You know, and then to go into the treatment process and essentially, as we're talking about that relationship, give up their best friend and try to realign their life with new coping skills. What a challenge and what a lot of courage.
Absolutely. Heroes, actually, is what I think. People who go into treatment and try to make this change. I'd like to add about denial. I loved what you said, Linda. We know that addiction is a disease. We know that the organ in the body that's impacted is the brain. And when we study the brain in people with active addiction, we see that their prefrontal cortex, where all their executive functioning resides, is completely cut out of the equation. And so that area where you can weigh the pros and cons of decisions that you need to make, when you make decisions in your best interest, all of that is cut off. So how can you at that point easily say, oh my gosh, I have this addiction and it's causing trouble, I need help for it? And also society is still not saying it's a disease. They're saying it's bad behavior. It looks like choice, and the issues that come when someone's actively addiction are often can be horrific in terms of their impact to others. But it is not bad people. It is a bad brain.
Well, and women have always been, you know, have been blamed for years for, you know, poor morals or whatever. And this is still persisting, as we were touching on earlier, that you're just, she's just a bad person. She's a loose woman
or
whatever.
Bad mom. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And so that adds to the shame and guilt, and also the less likelihood to reach out because you're too ashamed. You're too guilty. So you just keep kind of in the same rut so that maybe not any more people know what a bad person you have become.
And I really encourage family members to take a loving, non-confrontative, but, you know, consistent approach to dealing with the issue. And I know that's very, very difficult, but it does not get better without attention. It gets worse. And the higher somebody's bottom is, the less damage there is and the better the prognostic outcome.
Mm-hmm. You know, I want to bring up something that's a little bit different, but I think it's really worth noting that the female population in prisons, from what I understand, has a very high correlation with substance abuse. Can you speak to that, Twyla?
Yes, thank you for asking that. We see that the number of women in prison because of the drug law changes in the 1990s just skyrocketed the number of women getting admitted to prisons. It was hundreds of percentages more than it was for men. And they were being targeted for smaller, nonviolent crimes many times and getting very long punitive sentences, sometimes first felony offenses for possession resulting in 15 years. So a young woman who's got small children who gets imprisoned then has triple or quadruple jeopardy in her family because her children are unfairly impacted by that as well.
What were the changes that caused this?
Well, the drug laws that came about really targeted the middle people and the smaller people in terms of those who were using and possessing and selling in small amounts and committing crimes to support their addiction as opposed to the big players that were running the drug cartels. And so we got a lot of the little folks imprisoned, and it's just had a tragic effect on society, I think.
Why were more women getting put into prison when this changed?
Because often they were caught in relation to relationships that they were involved in. And I think that there was a punitive judicial system that unfairly targeted them. And, you know, there's no other disease that we imprison people for. It would be ludicrous to think of doing that for someone with diabetes or heart disease. And yet we have prisons full of people with the disease of addiction instead of sending them to treatment. And it's much more expensive to have someone in a prison for a year than to send someone even for 3 months of residential treatment.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, believe it or not, that is all we have time for today. I hope our discussion has been able to open your eyes to the unique challenges that are faced by women struggling with addiction. I want to thank our guests, Twyla Wilson and Linda Gingra, for taking time out of their busy days to be on Break the Chains. Twyla, would you like to tell people how they can contact you or learn a little bit more about you?
Yes. I can be reached at my Gmail account, which is twyla.lcsw@gmail.com for comments or questions. Also at therapists.psychologytoday.com. And you can find a lot of information about what we've talked about on Dr. Stephanie Covington's website, which is stephaniecovington.com, at the Center for Gender and Justice and the Institute for Relational Development.
And I might add, you spell Twyla, T-W-Y-L-A, because that's
right.
An unusual
Thank
name.
Thank you.
Linda, what would you like people to know resource-wise where you're concerned?
Okay, well, I could be reached for questions or comments at my email account, lgengra@jfsla.org. That's for Jewish Family Service Los Angeles.org. Jewish Family Service is a large social service agency that provides a continuum of social services to people of any background. And we have offices throughout Los Angeles. And if anybody nationwide is interested in finding gender-specific female resources that can assist them with addiction, they can visit the Women's Association for Addiction Treatment website at www.watt.us, and that will take them to a website that has a lot of resources for women dealing with addiction.
And that's waat.org, I think?
.us.
Oh, .us, I'm sorry. And also, because that you both threw out a lot that people probably didn't have time to write down, but both of our guests have bios on the My Talk Zone show page, and you'll also be able to figure out how to spell their names and find them that way.
I'd also like to add for a more modern twist that Stephanie Covington's book, A Woman's Way Through the 12 Steps, is available as an app on your iPhone or your smartphone. So for women who are looking for resources and daily comfort and support in recovery, that's available.
Okay, very, very good. Well, listen, I look forward to being with everybody again next Thursday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time when I'm going to be interviewing Dr. Sylvester Sviokla. Dr. Skip, as he prefers to be called, thank goodness, has written a new book called From Harvard to Hell and Back. And in it, he details how, as a brilliant Harvard-educated medical doctor, he lost it all through drug addiction and how he finally found redemption. So for now, this is your host, Gwen Carden. Be safe, live smart, and most of all, take good care of yourself.